discouraged by the small amount of interest it aroused. The other regarding sentiments had not been cultivated in Lily, and she was often bored by the relation of her friend's philanthropic efforts. But today her quick, dramatizing fancy seized on the contrast between her own situation and that represented by some of Goethe's cases. These were young girls like herself, some perhaps pretty, some not without a trace of her finer sensibilities. She pictured herself leading such a life as theirs, a life in which achievement seemed as squalid as failure, and the vision made her shudder sympathetically. The price of the dressing case was still in her pocket, and drawing out her little gold purse, she slipped a liberal fraction of the amount into Miss Farish's hand. The satisfaction derived from this act was all that the most ardent moralist could have desired. Lily felt a new interest in herself as a person of charitable instincts. She had never before thought of doing good with the wealth she had so often dreamed of possessing, but now her horizon was enlarged by the vision of a prodigal philanthropy. Moreover, by some obscure process of logic, she felt that her momentary burst of generosity had justified all previous extravagances and excused any in which she might subsequently indulge. Miss Farish's surprise and gratitude confirmed this feeling, and Lily parted from her with a sense of self-esteem which she naturally mistook for the fruits of altruism. About this time she was farther cheered by an invitation to spend the Thanksgiving week at a camp in the Adirondacks. The invitation was one which a year earlier would have provoked a less ready response, for the party, though organized by Mrs. Fisher, was ostensibly given by a lady of obscure origin and indomitable social ambitions, whose acquaintance Lily had hitherto avoided. Now, however, she was disposed to coincide with Mrs. Fisher's view that it didn't matter who gave the party as long as things were well done, and doing things well, under competent direction, was Mrs. Wellington Bry's strong point. The lady, whose consort was known as Welly Bry on the Stock Exchange and in sporting circles, had already sacrificed one husband and sundry minor considerations to her determination to get on, and having obtained a hold on Carrie Fisher, she was astute enough to perceive the wisdom of committing herself entirely to that lady's guidance. Everything accordingly was well done, for there was no limit to Mrs. Fisher's prodigality when she was not spending her own money, and as she remarked to her pupil, a good cook was the best introduction to society. If the company was not as select as the cuisine, the Welly Brys at least had the satisfaction of figuring for the first time in the society columns, in company with one or two noticeable names. And foremost among these was, of course, Miss Bartz. The young lady was treated by her hosts with corresponding deference, and she was in the mood when such attentions are acceptable, whatever their source. Mrs. Bry's admiration was a mirror in which Lily's self-complacency recovered its lost outline. No insect hangs its nest on threads as frail as those which will sustain the weight of human vanity, and the sense of being of importance among the insignificant was enough to restore to Miss Bart the gratifying consciousness of power. If these people paid court to her, it proved that she was still conspicuous in the world to which they aspired, and she was not above a certain enjoyment in dazzling them by her fineness, in developing their puzzled perception of her superiorities. Perhaps, however, her enjoyment proceeded more than she was aware from the physical stimulus of the excursion, the challenge of crisp cold and hard exercise, the responsive thrill of her body to the influences of the winter woods. She returned to town in a glow of rejuvenation, conscious of a clearer colour in her cheeks, a fresh elasticity in her muscles. The future seemed full of a vague promise, and all her apprehensions were swept out of sight on the buoyant current of her mood. A few days after her return to town, she had the unpleasant surprise of a visit from Mr. Rosedale. He came late, at the confidential hour when the tea-table still lingers by the fire in friendly expectancy, and his manner showed a readiness to adapt itself to the intimacy of the occasion. Lily, who had a vague sense of his being somehow connected with her lucky speculations, tried to give him the welcome he expected. But there was something in the quality of his geniality which chilled her own, and she was conscious of marking each step in their acquaintance by a fresh blunder. Mr. Rosedale, making himself promptly at home in an adjoining easy chair, and sipping his tea critically with the comment, "You ought to go to my man for something really good," appeared totally unconscious of the repugnance which kept her in frozen erectness behind the urn. It was perhaps her very manner of holding herself aloof that appealed to his collector's passion for the rare and unattainable. He gave, at any rate, no sign of resenting it, and seemed prepared to supply in his own manner all the ease that was lacking in hers. His object in calling was to ask her to go to the opera in his box on the opening night, and seeing her hesitate, he said persuasively, "Mrs. Fisher is coming, and I've secured a tremendous admirer of yours who'll never forgive me if you don't accept." As Lily's silence left him with this illusion on his hands, he nodded with a confidential smile. "Gus Trenor has promised to come to town on purpose. I fancy he'd go a good deal farther for the pleasure of seeing you." Miss Bart felt an inward motion of annoyance. It was distasteful enough to hear her name coupled with Trenor's, and on Rosedale's lips the allusion was peculiarly unpleasant. "The Trenors are my best friends. I think we should all go a long way to see each other," she said, absorbing herself in the preparation of fresh tea. Her visitor's smile grew increasingly intimate.
"Well, I wasn't thinking of Mrs. Trenor at the moment. They say Gus doesn't always, you know."
Then, dimly conscious that he had not struck the right note, he added with a well-meant effort at diversion,
"How's your luck been going in Wall Street, by the way? I hear Gus pulled off a nice little pile for you last month."
Lily put down the tea caddy with an abrupt gesture. She felt that her hands were trembling, and clasped them on her knee to steady them. But her lip trembled, too, and for a moment she was afraid the tremor might communicate itself to her voice. When she spoke, however, it was in a tone of perfect lightness. "Ah, yes, I had a little bit of money to invest, and Mr. Trenor, who helps me about such matters, advised my putting it in stocks, instead of a mortgage, as my aunt's agent wanted me to do. And as it happened, I made a lucky turn, is that what you call it? For you make a great many yourself, I believe." She was smiling back at him now, relaxing the tension of her attitude, and admitting him, by imperceptible gradations of glance and manner, a step farther toward intimacy. The protective instinct always nerved her to successful dissimulation, and it was not the first time she had used her beauty to divert attention from an inconvenient topic. When Mr. Rosedale took leave, he carried with him not only her acceptance of his invitation, but a general sense of having comported himself in a way calculated to advance his cause. He had always believed he had a light touch and a knowing way with women, and the prompt manner in which Miss Bart, as he would have phrased it, had come into line, confirmed his confidence in his powers of handling the skittish sex. Her way of glossing over the transaction with Trenor he regarded at once as a tribute to his own acuteness and a confirmation of his suspicions. The girl was evidently nervous, and Mr. Rosedale, if he saw no other means of advancing his acquaintance with her, was not above taking advantage of her nervousness. He left Lily to a passion of disgust and fear. It seemed incredible that Gus Trenor should have spoken of her to Rosedale. With all his faults, Trenor had the safeguard of his traditions, and was the less likely to overstep them because they were so purely instinctive. But Lily recalled with a pang that there were convivial moments when, as Judy had confided to her, Gus talked foolishly. In one of these, no doubt, the fatal word had slipped from him. As for Rosedale, she did not, after the first shock, greatly care what conclusions he had drawn. Though usually adroit enough where her own interests were concerned, she made the mistake, not uncommon to persons in whom social habits are instinctive, of supposing that the inability to acquire them quickly implies a general dullness. Because a blue bottle bangs irrationally against a window pane, the drawing-room naturalist may forget that under less artificial conditions it is capable of measuring distances and drawing conclusions with all the accuracy needful to its welfare. And the fact that Mr. Rosedale's drawing-room manner lacked perspective made Lily class him with Trenor and the other dull men she knew, and assume that a little flattery and the occasional acceptance of his hospitality would suffice to render him innocuous. However, there could be no doubt of the expediency of showing herself in his box on the opening night of the opera. And after all, Since Judy Trenor had promised to take him up that winter, it was as well to reap the advantage of being first in the field. For a day or two after Rosedale's visit, Lily's thoughts were dogged by the consciousness of Trenor's shadowy claim, and she wished she had a clearer notion of the exact nature of the transaction which seemed to have put her in his power. But her mind shrank from any unusual application, and she was always helplessly puzzled by figures. Moreover, she had not seen Trenor since the day of the Van Osburgh wedding, and in his continued absence the trace of Rosedale's words was soon effaced by other impressions. When the opening night of the opera came, her apprehensions had so completely vanished that the sight of Trenor's ruddy countenance in the back of Mr. Rosedale's box filled her with a sense of pleasant reassurance. Lily had not quite reconciled herself to the necessity of appearing as Rosedale's guest on so conspicuous an occasion, and it was a relief to find herself supported by anyone of her own set, for Mrs. Fisher's social habits were too promiscuous for her presence to justify Miss Bart's. To Lily, always inspirited by the prospect of showing her beauty in public, and conscious tonight of all the added enhancements of dress, the insistency of Trenor's gaze merged itself in the general stream of admiring looks of which she felt herself the centre. Ah, it was good to be young, to be radiant, to glow with the sense of slenderness, strength, and elasticity, of well-poised lines and happy tints, to feel oneself lifted to a height apart by that incommunicable grace which is the bodily counterpart of genius. All means seemed justifiable to attain such an end, or rather, by a happy shifting of lights with which practice had familiarized Miss Bart, the cause shrank to a pinpoint in the general brightness of the effect. But brilliant young ladies, a little blinded by their own effulgence, are apt to forget that the modest satellite drowned in their light is still performing its own revolutions and generating heat at its own rate. If Lily's poetic enjoyment of the moment was undisturbed by the base thought that her gown and opera cloak had been indirectly paid for by Gus Trenor, the latter had not sufficient poetry in his composition to lose sight of these prosaic facts. He knew only that he had never seen Lily look smarter in her life, that there wasn't a woman in the house who showed off good clothes as she did, and that hitherto he, to whom she owed the opportunity of making this display, had reaped no return beyond that of gazing at her in company with several hundred other pairs of eyes. It came to Lily, therefore, as a disagreeable surprise when in the back of the box, where they found themselves alone between two acts, Trenor said without preamble and in a tone of sulky authority,
"Look here, Lily, how's a fellow ever to see anything of you? I'm in town 3 or 4 days in the week, and you know a line to the club will always find me. But you don't seem to remember my existence nowadays, unless you want to get a tip out of me."
The fact that the remark was in distinctly bad taste did not make it any easier to answer, for Lily was vividly aware that it was not the moment for that drawing up of her slim figure and surprised lifting of the brows, by which she usually quelled incipient signs of familiarity. "I'm very much flattered by your wanting to see me," she returned, essaying lightness instead. "But unless you've mislaid my address, it would have been easy to find me any afternoon at my aunt's. In fact, I rather expected you to look me up there." If she hoped to mollify him by this last concession, the attempt was a failure, for he only replied, with the familiar lowering of the brows that made him look his dullest when he was angry,
"Hang going to your aunt's, wasting the afternoon listening to a lot of other chaps talking to you. You know I'm not the kind to sit in a crowd and jaw. I'd always rather clear out when that sort of circus is going on. Why can't we go off somewhere in a little lark together? A nice, quiet little expedition like that drive at Bellamont the day you met me at the station."
He leaned unpleasantly close in order to convey this suggestion, and she fancied she caught a significant aroma which explained the dark flush on his face and the glistening dampness of his forehead. The idea that any rash answer might provoke an unpleasant outburst tempered her disgust with caution, and she answered with a laugh, "I don't see how one can very well take country drives in town, but I'm not always surrounded by an admiring throng, and if you will let me know what afternoon you're coming, I will arrange things so that we can have a nice, quiet talk."
"Hang talking, that's what you always say," returned Trenor,
whose expletives lacked variety.
"You put me off with that at the Van Osburgh wedding. But the plain English of it is that now you've got what you wanted out of me, you'd rather have any other fellow about."
His voice had risen sharply with the last words, and Lily flushed with annoyance. But she kept command of the situation and laid a persuasive hand on his arm. "Don't be foolish, Gus. I can't let you talk to me in that ridiculous way. If you really want to see me, why shouldn't we take a walk in the park some afternoon? I agree with you that it's amusing to be rustic in town. And if you like, I'll meet you there, and we'll go and feed the squirrels. And you shall take me out on the lake in a steam gondola." She smiled as she spoke, letting her eyes rest on his in a way that took the edge from her banter and made him suddenly malleable to her will.
"All right, then. That's a go. Will you come tomorrow? Tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the end of the mall. I'll be there sharp, remember. You won't go back on me, Lily."
But to Miss Bart's relief, the repetition of her promise was cut short by the opening of the box door to admit George Dorset. Trenor sulkily yielded his place, and Lily turned a brilliant smile on the newcomer. She had not talked with Dorset since their visit at Bellamont, but something in his look and manner told her that he recalled the friendly footing on which they had last met. He was not a man to whom the expression of admiration came easily. His long, sallow face and distrustful eyes seemed always barricaded against the expansive emotions. But where her own influence was concerned, Lily's intuition sent out thread-like feelers, and as she made room for him on the narrow sofa, she was sure he found a dumb pleasure in being near her. Few women took the trouble to make themselves agreeable to Dorset, and Lily had been kind to him at Bellamont, and was now smiling on him with a divine renewal of kindness.
"Well, here we are, in for another 6 months of caterwauling," he began complainingly. "Not a shade of difference between this year and last, except that the women have got new clothes and the singers haven't got new voices. My wife's musical, you know, puts me through a course of this every winter. It isn't so bad on Italian nights. Then she comes late and there's time to digest. But when they give Wagner, we have to rush dinner and I pay up for it. And the drafts are damnable. Asphyxia in front and pleurisy in the back. There's Trenor leaving the box without drawing the curtain. With a hide like that, drafts don't make any difference. Did you ever watch Trenor eat? If you did, you'd wonder why he's alive. I suppose he's leather inside, too. But I came to say that my wife wants you to come down to our place next Sunday. Do, for heaven's sake, say yes. She's got a lot of bores coming. Intellectual ones, I mean. That's her new line, you know. And I'm not sure it ain't worse than the music. Some of 'em have long hair, and they start an argument with the soup, and don't notice when things are handed to them. The consequence is the dinner gets cold, and I have dyspepsia. That silly-ass Silverton brings him to the house. He writes poetry, you know, and Bertha and he are getting tremendously thick. She could write better than any of 'em if she chose, and I don't blame her for wanting clever fellows about. All I say is, don't let me see 'em eat."
The gist of this strange communication gave Lily a distinct thrill of pleasure. Under ordinary circumstances, there would have been nothing surprising in an invitation from Bertha Dorset. But since the Bellamont episode, an unavowed hostility had kept the two women apart. Now, with a start of inner wonder, Lily felt that her thirst for retaliation had died out. "If you would forgive your enemy," says the Malay proverb, "first inflict a hurt on him." And Lily was experiencing the truth of the apothegm. If she had destroyed Mrs. Dorset's letters, she might have continued to hate her. But the fact that they remained in her possession had fed her resentment to satiety. She uttered a smiling acceptance, hailing in the renewal of the tie an escape from Trenor's importunities. Chapter 11. Meanwhile, the holidays had gone by, and the season was beginning. Fifth Avenue had become a nightly torrent of carriages, surging upward to the fashionable quarters about the park, where illuminated windows and outspread awnings betokened the usual routine of hospitality. Other tributary currents crossed the main stream, bearing their freight to the theatres, restaurants, or opera. And Mrs. Peniston, from the secluded watchtower of her upper window, could tell to a nicety just when the chronic volume of sound was increased by the sudden influx setting toward a Van Osburgh ball, or when the multiplication of wheels meant merely that the opera was over, or that there was a big supper at Sherry's. Mrs. Peniston followed the rise and culmination of the season as keenly as the most active sharer in its gaieties, and as a looker-on she enjoyed opportunities of comparison and generalization, such as those who take part must proverbially forego. No one could have kept a more accurate record of social fluctuations, or have put a more unerring finger on the distinguishing features of each season, its dullness, its extravagance, its lack of balls, or excessive divorces. She had a special memory for the vicissitudes of the new people who rose to the surface with each recurring tide, and were either submerged beneath its rush, or landed triumphantly beyond the reach of envious breakers. And she was apt to display a remarkable retrospective insight into their ultimate fate, so that when they had fulfilled their destiny, she was almost always able to say to Grace Stepney, the recipient of her prophecies, that she had known exactly what would happen. This particular season, Mrs. Peniston would have characterized as that in which everybody felt poor except the Welly Brys and Mr. Simon Rosedale. It had been a bad autumn in Wall Street, where prices fell in accordance with that peculiar law which proves railway stocks and bales of cotton to be more sensitive to the allotment of executive power than many estimable citizens trained to all the advantages of self-government. Even fortunes supposed to be independent of the market either betrayed a secret dependence on it or suffered from a sympathetic affection. Fashion sulked in its country houses or came to town incognito. General entertainments were discountenanced, and informality and short dinners became the fashion. But society, amused for a while at playing Cinderella, soon wearied of the hearthside role, and welcomed the fairy godmother in the shape of any magician powerful enough to turn the shrunken pumpkin back again into the golden coach. The mere fact of growing richer at a time when most people's investments are shrinking is calculated to attract envious attention, and according to Wall Street rumors, Welly Bry and Rosedale had found the secret of performing this miracle. Rosedale, in particular, was said to have doubled his fortune, and there was talk of his buying the newly finished house of one of the victims of the crash, who in the space of 12 short months had made the same number of millions, built a house in Fifth Avenue, filled a picture gallery with old masters, entertained all New York in it, and been smuggled out of the country between a trained nurse and a doctor, while his creditors mounted guard over the old masters, and his guests explained to each other that they had dined with him only because they wanted to see the pictures. Mr. Rosedale meant to have a less meteoric career. He knew he should have to go slowly, and the instincts of his race fitted him to suffer rebuffs and put up with delays. But he was prompt to perceive that the general dullness of the season afforded him an unusual opportunity to shine, and he set about with patient industry to form a background for his growing glory. Mrs. Fisher was of immense service to him at this period. She had set off so many newcomers on the social stage that she was like one of those pieces of stock scenery which tell the experienced spectator exactly what is going to take place. But Mr. Rosedale wanted, in the long run, a more individual environment. He was sensitive to shades of difference which Miss Bart would never have credited him with perceiving, because he had no corresponding variations of manner, and it was becoming more and more clear to him that Miss Bart herself possessed precisely the complementary qualities needed to round off his social personality. Such details did not fall within the range of Mrs. Peniston's vision. Like many minds of panoramic sweep, hers was apt to overlook the minutiae of the foreground, and she was much more likely to know where Carrie Fisher had found the Welly Brys chef for them than what was happening to her own niece. She was not, however, without purveyors of information ready to supplement her deficiencies. Grace Stepney's mind was like a kind of moral flypaper, to which the buzzing items of gossip were drawn by a fatal attraction, and where they hung fast in the toils of an inexorable memory. Lily would have been surprised to know how many trivial facts concerning herself were lodged in Miss Stepney's head. She was quite aware that she was of interest to dingy people, but she assumed that there is only one form of dinginess, and that admiration for brilliancy is a natural expression of its inferior state. She knew that Gertie Farish admired her blindly, and therefore supposed that she inspired the same sentiments in Grace Stepney, whom she classified as a Gertie Farish without the saving traits of youth and enthusiasm. In reality, the two differed from each other as much as they differed from the object of their mutual contemplation. Miss Farish's heart was a fountain of tender illusions. Miss Stepney's a precise register of facts, as manifested in their relation to herself. She had sensibilities which to Lily would have seemed comic in a person with a freckled nose and red eyelids, who lived in a boarding-house and admired Mrs. Peniston's drawing-room. But poor Grace's limitations gave them a more concentrated inner life, as poor soil starves certain plants into intenser efflorescence. She had, in truth, no abstract propensity to malice. She did not dislike Lily because the latter was brilliant and predominant, but because she thought that Lily disliked her. It is less mortifying to believe oneself unpopular than insignificant, and vanity prefers to assume that indifference is a latent form of unfriendliness. Even such scant civilities as Lily accorded to Mr. Rosedale would have made Miss Stepney her friend for life. But how could she foresee that such a friend was worth cultivating? How, moreover, can a young woman who has never been ignored measure the pang which this injury inflicts? And lastly, how could Lily, accustomed to choose between a pressure of engagements, guess that she had mortally offended Miss Stepney by causing her to be excluded from one of Mrs. Peniston's infrequent dinner parties? Mrs. Peniston disliked giving dinners, but she had a high sense of family obligation, and on the Jack Stepneys' return from their honeymoon, she felt it incumbent upon her to light the drawing-room lamps and extract her best silver from the safe-deposit vaults. Mrs. Peniston's rare entertainments were preceded by days of heart-rending vacillation as to every detail of the feast, from the seating of the guests to the pattern of the tablecloth, and in the course of one of these preliminary discussions, she had imprudently suggested to her cousin Grace that as the dinner was a family affair, she might be included in it. For a week, the prospect had lighted up Miss Stepney's colourless existence. Then she had been given to understand that it would be more convenient to have her another day. Miss Stepney knew exactly what had happened. Lily, to whom family reunions were occasions of unalloyed dullness, had persuaded her aunt that a dinner of smart people would be much more to the taste of the young couple, and Mrs. Peniston, who leaned helplessly on her niece in social matters, had been prevailed upon to pronounce Grace's exile. After all, Grace could come any other day. Why should she mind being put off? It was precisely because Miss Stepney could come any other day, and because she knew her relations were in the secret of her unoccupied evenings, that this incident loomed gigantically on her horizon. She was aware that she had Lily to thank for it, and dull resentment was turned to active animosity. Mrs. Peniston, on whom she had looked in a day or two after the dinner, laid down her crochet work and turned abruptly from her oblique survey of Fifth Avenue. "Gus Trenor? Lily and Gus Trenor?" she said, growing so suddenly pale that her visitor was almost alarmed. "Oh, Cousin Julia, of course I don't mean—" "I don't know what you do mean," said Mrs. Peniston, with a frightened quiver in her small, fretful voice. "Such things were never heard of in my day, and my own niece! I'm not sure I understand you. Do people say he's in love with her?" Mrs. Peniston's horror was genuine. Though she boasted an unequalled familiarity with the secret chronicles of society, she had the innocence of the schoolgirl who regards wickedness as a part of history, and to whom it never occurs that the scandals she reads of in lesson hours may be repeating themselves in the next street. Mrs. Peniston had kept her imagination shrouded, like the drawing-room furniture. She knew, of course, that society was very much changed, and that many women her mother would have thought peculiar were now in a position to be critical about their visiting lists. She had discussed the perils of divorce with her rector, and had felt thankful at times that Lily was still unmarried. But the idea that any scandal could attach to a young girl's name, above all that it could be lightly coupled with that of a married man, was so new to her that she was as much aghast as if she had been accused of leaving her carpets down all summer, or of violating any of the other cardinal laws of housekeeping. Miss Stepney, when her first fright had subsided, began to feel the superiority that greater breadth of mind confers. It was really pitiable to be as ignorant of the world as Mrs. Peniston. She smiled at the latter's question. "People always say unpleasant things, and certainly they're a great deal together. A friend of mine met them the other afternoon in the park, quite late, after the lamps were lit. It's a pity Lily makes herself so conspicuous. "Conspicuous," gasped Mrs. Peniston. She bent forward, lowering her voice to mitigate the horror. "What sort of things do they say? That he means to get a divorce and marry her?" Grace Stepney laughed outright. "Dear me, no. He would hardly do that. It's a flirtation, nothing more." "A flirtation? Between my niece and a married man? Do you mean to tell me that with Lily's looks and advantages she could find no better use for her time than to waste it on a fat, stupid man almost old enough to be her father?" This argument had such a convincing ring that it gave Mrs. Peniston sufficient reassurance to pick up her work while she waited for Grace Stepney to rally her scattered forces. But Miss Stepney was on the spot in an instant. "That's the worst of it. People say she isn't wasting her time. Everyone knows, as you say, that Lily is too handsome and charming to devote herself to a man like Gus Trenor, unless—" "Unless," echoed Mrs. Peniston. Her visitor drew breath nervously. It was agreeable to shock Mrs. Peniston, but not to shock her to the verge of anger. Miss Stepney was not sufficiently familiar with the classic drama to have recalled in advance how bearers of bad tidings are proverbially received. But she now had a rapid vision of forfeited dinners and a reduced wardrobe as the possible consequence of her disinterestedness. To the honour of her sex, however, hatred of Lily prevailed over more personal considerations. Mrs. Peniston had chosen the wrong moment to boast of her niece's charms. "Unless," said Grace, leaning forward to speak with low-toned emphasis, "unless there are material advantages to be gained by making herself agreeable to him." She felt that the moment was tremendous, and remembered suddenly that Mrs. Peniston's black brocade with the cut jet fringe would have been hers at the end of the season. Mrs. Peniston put down her work again. Another aspect of the same idea had presented itself to her, and she felt that it was beneath her dignity to have her nerves racked by a dependent relative who wore her old clothes. "If you take pleasure in annoying me by mysterious insinuations," she said coldly, "you might at least have chosen a more suitable time than just as I am recovering from the strain of giving a large dinner." The mention of the dinner dispelled Miss Stepney's last scruples. "I don't know why I should be accused of taking pleasure in telling you about Lily. I was sure I shouldn't get any thanks for it," she returned with a flare of temper. "But I have some family feeling left, and as you are the only person who has any authority over Lily, I thought you ought to know what is being said of her." "Well," said Mrs. Peniston, "what I complain of is that you haven't told me yet what is being said." "I didn't suppose I should have to put it so plainly. People say that Gus Trenor pays her bills." "Pays her bills? Her bills?" Mrs. Peniston broke into a laugh. "I can't imagine where you could have picked up such rubbish. Lily has her own income, and I provide for her very handsomely." "Oh, we all know that," interposed Miss Stepney dryly. "But Lily wears a great many smart gowns. I like her to be well-dressed. It's only suitable." "Certainly. But then there are her gambling debts besides." Miss Stepney, in the beginning, had not meant to bring up this point. But Mrs. Peniston had only her own incredulity to blame. She was like the stiff-necked unbelievers of Scripture, who must be annihilated to be convinced.
"Gambling debts? Lily?"
Mrs. Peniston's voice shook with anger and bewilderment. She wondered whether Grace Stepney had gone out of her mind.
"What do you mean by her gambling debts?"
"Simply that if one plays bridge for money in Lily's set, one is liable to lose a great deal, and I don't suppose Lily always wins."
"Who told you that my niece played cards for money?"
"Mercy, Cousin Julia, don't look at me as if I were trying to turn you against Lily. Everybody knows she's crazy about bridge. Mrs. Grice told me herself that it was her gambling that frightened Percy Grice. It seems he was really taken with her at first. But of course, among Lily's friends, it's quite the custom for girls to play for money. In fact, people are inclined to excuse her on that account."
"To excuse her for what?"
"For being hard up, and accepting attentions from men like Gus Trenor and George Dorset." Mrs. Peniston gave another cry.
"George Dorset? Is there anyone else? I should like to know the worst, if you please."
"Don't put it in that way, Cousin Julia. Lately, Lily has been a good deal with the Dorsets, and he seems to admire her, But, of course, that's only natural. And I'm sure there's no truth in the horrid things people say. But she has been spending a great deal of money this winter. Evie van Osburgh was at Celeste's ordering her trousseau the other day. Yes, the marriage takes place next month. And she told me that Celeste showed her the most exquisite things she was just sending home to Lily. And people say that Judy Trenor has quarrelled with her on account of Gus. But I'm sure I'm sorry I spoke, though I only meant it as a kindness. Mrs. Peniston's genuine incredulity enabled her to dismiss Miss Stepney with a disdain which boded ill for that lady's prospect of succeeding to the black brocade. But minds impenetrable to reason have generally some crack through which suspicion filters, and her visitor's insinuations did not glide off as easily as she had expected. Mrs. Peniston disliked scenes, and her determination to avoid them had always led her to hold herself aloof from the details of Lily's life. In her youth, girls had not been supposed to require close supervision. They were generally assumed to be taken up with the legitimate business of courtship and marriage, and interference in such affairs on the part of their natural guardians was considered as unwarrantable as a spectator's suddenly joining in a game. There had, of course, been fast girls, even in Mrs. Peniston's early experience, but their fastness, at worst, was understood to be a mere excess of animal spirits, against which there could be no graver charge than that of being unladylike. The modern fastness appeared synonymous with immorality, and the mere idea of immorality was as offensive to Mrs. Peniston as a smell of cooking in the drawing-room. It was one of the conceptions her mind refused to admit. She had no immediate intention of repeating to Lily what she had heard, or even of trying to ascertain its truth by means of discreet interrogation. To do so might be to provoke a scene, and a scene, in the shaken state of Mrs. Peniston's nerves, with the effects of her dinner not worn off, and her mind still tremulous with new impressions, was a risk she deemed it her duty to avoid. But there remained in her thoughts a settled deposit of resentment against her niece, all the denser because it was not to be cleared by explanation or discussion. It was horrible of a young girl to let herself be talked about. However unfounded the charges against her, she must be to blame for their having been made. Mrs. Peniston felt as if there had been a contagious illness in the house, and she was doomed to sit shivering among her contaminated furniture. Chapter 12. Miss Bart had in fact been treading a devious way, and none of her critics could have been more alive to the fact than herself. But she had a fatalistic sense of being drawn from one wrong turning to another, without ever perceiving the right road, till it was too late to take it. Lily, who considered herself above narrow prejudices, had not imagined that the fact of letting Gus Trenor make a little money for her would ever disturb her self-complacency. And the fact in itself still seemed harmless enough, only it was a fertile source of harmful complications. As she exhausted the amusement of spending the money, these complications became more pressing, and Lily, whose mind could be severely logical in tracing the causes of her ill luck to others, justified herself by the thought that she owed all her troubles to the enmity of Bertha Dorset. This enmity, however, had apparently expired in a renewal of friendliness between the two women. Lily's visit to the Dorsets had resulted for both in the discovery that they could be of use to each other, and the civilized instinct finds a subtler pleasure in making use of its antagonist than in confounding him. Mrs. Dorset was, in fact, engaged in a new sentimental experiment, of which Mrs. Fisher's late property, Ned Silverton, was the rosy victim. And at such moments, as Judy Trenor had once remarked, she felt a peculiar need of distracting her husband's attention. Dorset was as difficult to amuse as a savage, but even his self-engrossment was not proof against Lily's arts, or rather, these were especially adapted to soothe an uneasy egoism. Her experience with Percy Gryce stood her in good stead in ministering to Dorset's humours, and if the incentive to please was less urgent, the difficulties of her situation were teaching her to make much of minor opportunities. Intimacy with the Dorsets was not likely to lessen such difficulties on the material side. Mrs. Dorset had none of Judy Trenor's lavish impulses, and Dorset's admiration was not likely to express itself in financial tips, even had Lily cared to renew her experiences in that line. What she required for the moment of the Dorsets' friendship was simply its social sanction. She knew that people were beginning to talk of her, but this fact did not alarm her as it had alarmed Mrs. Peniston. In her set, such gossip was not unusual, and a handsome girl who flirted with a married man was merely assumed to be pressing to the limit of her opportunities. It was Trenor himself who frightened her. Their walk in the park had not been a success. Trenor had married young, and since his marriage, his intercourse with women had not taken the form of the sentimental small talk which doubles upon itself like the paths in a maze. He was first puzzled, and then irritated, to find himself always led back to the same starting point, and Lily felt that she was gradually losing control of the situation. Trenor was in truth in an unmanageable mood. In spite of his understanding with Rosedale, he had been somewhat heavily touched by the fall in stocks. His household expenses weighed on him, and he seemed to be meeting on all sides a sullen opposition to his wishes, instead of the easy good luck he had hitherto encountered. Mrs. Trenor was still at Bellamont, keeping the townhouse open and descending on it now and then for a taste of the world, but preferring the recurrent excitement of weekend parties to the restrictions of a dull season. Since the holidays, she had not urged Lily to return to Bellamont, and the first time they met in town, Lily fancied there was a shade of coldness in her manner. Was it merely the expression of her displeasure at Miss Bart's neglect, or had disquieting rumours reached her? The latter contingency seemed improbable, yet Lily was not without a sense of uneasiness. If her roaming sympathies had struck root anywhere, it was in her friendship with Judy Trenor. She believed in the sincerity of her friend's affection, though it sometimes showed itself in self-interested ways, and she shrank with peculiar reluctance from any risk of estranging it. But aside from this, she was keenly conscious of the way in which such an estrangement would react on herself. The fact that Gus Trenor was Judy's husband was at times Lily's strongest reason for disliking him and for resenting the obligation under which he had placed her. To set her doubts at rest, Miss Bart, soon after the new year, proposed herself for a weekend at Bellamont. She had learned in advance that the presence of a large party would protect her from too great assiduity on Trenor's part, and his wife's telegraphic "come by all means" seemed to assure her of her usual welcome. Judy received her amicably. The cares of a large party always prevailed over personal feelings, and Lily saw no change in her hostess's manner. Nevertheless, she was soon aware that the experiment of coming to Bellamont was destined not to be successful. The party was made up of what Mrs. Trenor called pokey people, her generic name for persons who did not play bridge, and it being her habit to group all such obstructionists in one class, she usually invited them together, regardless of their other characteristics. The result was apt to be an irreducible combination of persons having no other quality in common than their abstinence from bridge, and the antagonisms developed in a group lacking the one taste which might have amalgamated them were in this case aggravated by bad weather and by the ill-concealed boredom of their host and hostess. In such emergencies, Judy would usually have turned to Lily to fuse the discordant elements, and Miss Bart, assuming that such a service was expected of her, threw herself into it with her accustomed zeal. But at the outset, she perceived a subtle resistance to her efforts. If Mrs. Trenor's manner toward her was unchanged, there was certainly a faint coldness in that of the other ladies. An occasional caustic allusion to "your friends the Wellington Brys," or to "the little Jew who has bought the Griner house, someone told us you knew him, Miss Bart," showed Lily that she was in disfavour with that portion of society which, while contributing least to its amusement, has assumed the right to decide what forms that amusement shall take. The indication was a slight one, and a year ago Lily would have smiled at it, trusting to the charm of her personality to dispel any prejudice against her. But now she had grown more sensitive to criticism and less confident in her power of disarming it. She knew, moreover, that if the ladies at Bellamont permitted themselves to criticize her friends openly, it was a proof that they were not afraid of subjecting her to the same treatment behind her back. The nervous dread lest anything in Trenor's manner should seem to justify their disapproval made her seek every pretext for avoiding him, and she left Bellamont conscious of having failed in every purpose which had taken her there. In town, she returned to preoccupations which, for the moment, had the happy effect of banishing troublesome thoughts. The Welly Brys, after much debate and anxious counsel with their newly acquired friends, had decided on the bold move of giving a general entertainment. To attack society collectively, when one's means of approach are limited to a few acquaintances, is like advancing into a strange country with an insufficient number of scouts. But such rash tactics have sometimes led to brilliant victories, and the Brys had determined to put their fate to the touch. Mrs. Fisher, to whom they had entrusted the conduct of the affair, had decided that tableau vivant and expensive music were the two baits most likely to attract the desired prey, and after prolonged negotiations and the kind of wire-pulling in which she was known to excel, she had induced a dozen fashionable women to exhibit themselves in a series of pictures, which, by a farther miracle of persuasion, the distinguished portrait painter Paul Morpeth had been prevailed upon to organize. Lily was in her element on such occasions. Under Morpeth's guidance, her vivid plastic sense, hitherto nurtured on no higher food than dressmaking and upholstery, found eager expression in the disposal of draperies, the study of attitudes, the shifting of lights and shadows. Her dramatic instinct was roused by the choice of subjects, and the gorgeous reproductions of historic dress stirred an imagination which only visual impressions could reach. But keenest of all was the exhilaration of displaying her own beauty under a new aspect, of showing that her loveliness was no mere fixed quality, but an element shaping all emotions to fresh forms of grace. Mrs. Fisher's measures had been well taken, and society, surprised in a dull moment, succumbed to the temptation of Mrs. Bry's hospitality. The protesting minority were forgotten in the throng which abjured and came, and the audience was almost as brilliant as the show. Lawrence Selden was among those who had yielded to the proffered inducements. If he did not often act on the accepted social axiom that a man may go where he pleases, it was because he had long since learned that his pleasures were mainly to be found in a small group of the like-minded. But he enjoyed spectacular effects, and was not insensible to the part money plays in their production. All he asked was that the very rich should live up to their calling as stage managers, and not spend their money in a dull way. This the Brys could certainly not be charged with doing. Their recently built house, whatever it might lack as a frame for domesticity, was almost as well designed for the display of a festal assemblage as one of those airy pleasure halls which the Italian architects improvised to set off the hospitality of princes. The air of improvisation was in fact strikingly present. So recent, so rapidly evoked was the whole mise-en-scène that one had to touch the marble columns to learn they were not of cardboard, to seat oneself in one of the damask and gold armchairs to be sure it was not painted against the wall. Selden, who had put one of these seats to the test, found himself, from an angle of the ballroom, surveying the scene with frank enjoyment. The company, in obedience to the decorative instinct which calls for fine clothes in fine surroundings, had dressed rather with an eye to Mrs. Bry's background than to herself. The seated throng, filling the immense room without undue crowding, presented a surface of rich tissues and jewelled shoulders in harmony with the festooned and gilded walls and the flushed splendours of the Venetian ceiling. At the farther end of the room, a stage had been constructed behind a proscenium arch, curtained with folds of old damask. But in the pause before the parting of the folds, there was little thought of what they might reveal, for every woman who had accepted Mrs. Bry's invitation was engaged in trying to find out how many of her friends had done the same. Gertie Farish, seated next to Selden, was lost in that indiscriminate and uncritical enjoyment so irritating to Miss Bart's finer perceptions. It may be that Selden's nearness had something to do with the quality of his cousin's pleasure, but Miss Farish was so little accustomed to refer her enjoyment of such scenes to her own share in them that she was merely conscious of a deeper sense of contentment. "Wasn't it dear of Lily to get me an invitation? Of course it would never have occurred to Carrie Fisher to put me on the list, and I should have been so sorry to miss seeing it all, and especially Lily herself. Someone told me the ceiling was by Veronese. You would know, of course, Lawrence. I suppose it's very beautiful, but his women are so dreadfully fat. Goddesses? Well, I can only say that if they'd been mortals and had to wear corsets, it would have been better for them. I think our women are much handsomer. And this room is wonderfully becoming. Everyone looks so well. Did you ever see such jewels? Do look at Mrs. George Dorset's pearls. I suppose the smallest of them would pay the rent of our girls' club for a year. Not that I ought to complain about the club. Everyone has been so wonderfully kind. Did I tell you that Lily had given us $300? Wasn't it splendid of her? And then she collected a lot of money from her friends. Mrs. Bry gave us 500, and Mr. Rosedale 1,000. I wish Lily were not so nice to Mr. Rosedale, but she says it's no use being rude to him, because he doesn't see the difference. She really can't bear to hurt people's feelings. It makes me so angry when I hear her called cold and conceited. The girls at the club don't call her that. Do you know she's been there with me twice? Yes, Lily. And you should have seen their eyes. One of them said it was as good as a day in the country just to look at her. And she sat there and laughed and talked with them, not a bit as if she were being charitable, you know, but as if she liked it as much as they did. They've been asking ever since when she's coming back, and she's promised me—oh. Miss Farish's confidences were cut short by the parting of the curtain on the first tableau, a group of nymphs dancing across flower-strewn sward in the rhythmic postures of Botticelli's Spring. Tableaux vivants depend for their effect not only on the happy disposal of lights and the delusive interposition of layers of gauze, but on a corresponding adjustment of the mental vision. To unfurnished minds, they remain, in spite of every enhancement of art, only a superior kind of waxworks. But to the responsive fancy, they may give magic glimpses of the boundary world between fact and imagination. Selden's mind was of this order. He could yield to vision-making influences as completely as a child to the spell of a fairy tale. Mrs. Bry's tableau wanted none of the qualities which go to the producing of such illusions, and under Morpeth's organizing hand, the pictures succeeded each other with the rhythmic march of some splendid frieze, in which the fugitive curves of living flesh and the wandering light of young eyes have been subdued to plastic harmony without losing the charm of life. The scenes were taken from old pictures, and the participators had been cleverly fitted with characters suited to their types. No one, for instance, could have made a more typical Goya than Carrie Fisher, with her short, dark-skinned face, the exaggerated glow of her eyes, and the provocation of her frankly painted smile. A brilliant Miss Smedden from Brooklyn showed to perfection the sumptuous curves of Titian's daughter, lifting her gold salver laden with grapes above the harmonizing gold of rippled hair and rich brocade, and a young Mrs. Van Alstyne, who showed the frailer Dutch type, with high blue-veined forehead and pale eyes and lashes, made a characteristic Van Dyck in black satin against a curtained archway. Then there were Kaufman nymphs garlanding the altar of love, a Veronese supper, all sheeny textures, pearl-woven heads and marble architecture, and a Watteau group of lute-playing comedians lounging by a fountain in a sunlit glade. Each evanescent picture touched the vision-building faculty in Selden, leading him so far down the vistas of fancy that even Gertie Farish's running commentary, "Oh, how lovely Lulu Melson looks," or "That must be Kate Corby to the right there, in purple," did not break the spell of the illusion. Indeed, so skilfully had the personality of the actors been subdued to the scenes they figured in, that even the least imaginative of the audience must have felt a thrill of contrast when the curtain suddenly parted on a picture which was simply and undisguisedly the portrait of Miss Bart. Here there could be no mistaking the predominance of personality. The unanimous "Oh!" of the spectators was a tribute not to the brushwork of Reynolds' Mrs. Lloyd, but to the flesh-and-blood loveliness of Lily Bart. She had shown her artistic intelligence in selecting a type so like her own that she could embody the person represented without ceasing to be herself. It was as though she had stepped not out of, but into, Reynolds' canvas, banishing the phantom of his dead beauty by the beams of her living grace. The impulse to show herself in a splendid setting, she had thought for a moment of representing Tiepolo's Cleopatra, had yielded to the truer instinct of trusting to her unassisted beauty, and she had purposely chosen a picture without distracting accessories of dress or surroundings. Her pale draperies and the background of foliage against which she stood served only to relieve the long, dryad-like curves that swept upward from her poised foot to her lifted arm. The noble buoyancy of her attitude, its suggestion of soaring grace, revealed the touch of poetry in her beauty that Selden always felt in her presence, yet lost the sense of when he was not with her. Its expression was now so vivid that for the first time he seemed to see before him the real Lily Bart, divested of the trivialities of her little world, and catching for a moment a note of that eternal harmony of which her beauty was a part.
"Deuced bold thing to show herself in that get-up. But, gad, there isn't a break in the lines anywhere, and I suppose she wanted us to know it."
These words, uttered by that experienced connoisseur, Mr. Ned Van Alstyne, whose scented white moustache had brushed Selden's shoulder whenever the parting of the curtains presented any exceptional opportunity for the study of the female outline, affected their hearer in an unexpected way. It was not the first time that Selden had heard Lily's beauty lightly remarked on, and hitherto the tone of the comments had imperceptibly coloured his view of her. But now it woke only emotion of indignant contempt. This was the world she lived in. These were the standards by which she was fated to be measured. Does one go to Caliban for a judgment on Miranda? In the long moment before the curtain fell, he had time to feel the whole tragedy of her life. It was as though her beauty, thus detached from all that cheapened and vulgarized it, had held out suppliant hands to him from the world in which he and she had once met for a moment, and where he felt an overmastering longing to be with her again. He was roused by the pressure of ecstatic fingers. "Wasn't she too beautiful, Lawrence? Don't you like her best in that simple dress? It makes her look like the real Lily, the Lily I know." He met Gertie Farish's brimming gaze. "The Lily we know," he corrected. And his cousin, beaming at the implied understanding, exclaimed joyfully, "I'll tell her that. She always says you dislike her." The performance over, Selden's first impulse was to seek Miss Bart. During the interlude of music which succeeded the tableau, the actors had seated themselves here and there in the audience, diversifying its conventional appearance by the varied picturesqueness of their dress. Lily, however, was not among them, and her absence served to protract the effect she had produced on Selden. It would have broken the spell to see her too soon in the surroundings from which accident had so happily detached her. They had not met since the day of the Van Osburgh wedding, and on his side the avoidance had been intentional. Tonight, however, he knew that sooner or later he should find himself at her side, and though he let the dispersing crowd drift him whither it would, without making an immediate effort to reach her, his procrastination was not due to any lingering resistance, but to the desire to luxuriate a moment in the sense of complete surrender. Lily had not an instant's doubt as to the meaning of the murmur greeting her appearance. No other tableau had been received with that precise note of approval. It had obviously been called forth by herself, and not by the picture she impersonated. She had feared, at the last moment, that she was risking too much in dispensing with the advantages of a more sumptuous setting, and the completeness of her triumph gave her an intoxicating sense of recovered power. Not caring to diminish the impression she had produced, she held herself aloof from the audience till the movement of dispersal before supper, and thus had a second opportunity of showing herself to advantage, as the throng poured slowly into the empty drawing-room where she was standing. She was soon the centre of a group which increased and renewed itself as the circulation became general, and the individual comments on her success were a delightful prolongation of the collective applause. At such moments she lost something of her natural fastidiousness, and cared less for the quality of the admiration received than for its quantity. Differences of personality were merged in a warm atmosphere of praise, in which her beauty expanded like a flower in sunlight. And if Selden had approached a moment or two sooner, he would have seen her turning on Ned Van Alstyne and George Dorset the look he had dreamed of capturing for himself. Fortune willed, however, that the hurried approach of Mrs. Fisher, as whose aide-de-camp Van Alstyne was acting, should break up the group before Selden reached the threshold of the room. One or two of the men wandered off in search of their partners for supper, and the others, noticing Selden's approach, gave way to him in accordance with the tacit freemasonry of the ballroom. Lily was therefore standing alone when he reached her, and finding the expected look in her eye, he had the satisfaction of supposing he had kindled it. The look did indeed deepen as it rested on him, for even in that moment of self-intoxication, Lily felt the quicker beat of life that his nearness always produced. She read, too, in his answering gaze, the delicious confirmation of her triumph. And for the moment, it seemed to her that it was for him only she cared to be beautiful. Selden had given her his arm without speaking. She took it in silence, and they moved away, not toward the supper-room, but against the tide which was setting thither. The faces about her flowed by like the streaming images of sleep. She hardly noticed where Selden was leading her, till they passed through a glass doorway at the end of the long suite of rooms, and stood suddenly in the fragrant hush of a garden. Gravel grated beneath their feet, and about them was the transparent dimness of a midsummer night. Hanging lights made emerald caverns in the depths of foliage, and whitened the spray of a fountain falling among lilies. The magic place was deserted. There was no sound but the plash of the water on the lily pads, and a distant drift of music that might have been blown across a sleeping lake. Selden and Lily stood still, accepting the unreality of the scene as a part of their own dreamlike sensations. It would not have surprised them to feel a summer breeze on their faces, or to see the lights among the boughs reduplicated in the arch of a starry sky. The strange solitude about them was no stranger than the sweetness of being alone in it together. At length, Lily withdrew her hand and moved away a step, so that her white-robed slimness was outlined against the dusk of the branches. Selden followed her, and still without speaking, they seated themselves on a bench beside the fountain. Suddenly she raised her eyes with the beseeching earnestness of a child. "You never speak to me. You think hard things of me," she murmured.
"I think of you, at any rate, God knows," he said.
"Then why do we never see each other? Why can't we be friends? You promised once to help me," she continued in the same tone, as though the words were drawn from her unwillingly.
"The only way I can help you is by loving you," Selden said in a low voice.
She made no reply, but her face turned to him with the soft motion of a flower. His own met it slowly, and their lips touched. She drew back and rose from her seat. Selden rose too, and they stood facing each other. Suddenly she caught his hand and pressed it a moment against her cheek. "Ah, love me, but don't tell me so," she sighed with her eyes in his. And before he could speak, she had turned and slipped through the arch of boughs, disappearing in the brightness of the room beyond. Selden stood where she had left him. He knew too well the transiency of exquisite moments to attempt to follow her. But presently he re-entered the house and made his way through the deserted rooms to the door. A few sumptuously cloaked ladies were already gathered in the marble vestibule, and in the coat room he found Van Alstyne and Gus Trenor. The former, at Selden's approach, paused in the careful selection of a cigar from one of the silver boxes invitingly set out near the